From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
They asked me whether I was in the service of a foreign agent, or was I a foreign agent? And I said, yes, I'm in the service of an authority. And they said, is this authority outside of the United States? I said, yes. And they said, are you ready, Mr. Fast, to name the authority? And I said, yes, I'll name the authority. They said, very well, name it. And I said, God. He said, get that bastard out of here.
Today, legendary author Howard Fast, once jailed for his political beliefs. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! To name it. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Battling to repower his agenda, President Clinton is calling for a multi-billion-dollar effort to renew the nation's secondary schools. In a week in which he's been spotlighting an issue a day, the president was joining forces today with Senator Carol Mosley Braun, Democrat of Illinois, at a Southside Chicago elementary school to push a plan to use federal tax credits to leverage billions of dollars in interest-free loans to build and rehabilitate thousands of schools. A Senate vote on the issue was set shortly after Congress returns from its recess 2 weeks from now, and Clinton told reporters last night that it would not pass easily. The president's issue blitz began on Monday when he announced a new crackdown on the imports of assault-style weapons from abroad. On Tuesday, he discussed the future of Social Security at a town meeting in Kansas City. After today's pitch on education, Clinton's flying to Kentucky to meet Thursday with local farmers to discuss efforts to place historic curbs on the tobacco industry. Congressmember Gerald Solomon, Republican of New York, has apologized for using a term that some consider racist, but says he won't back off his harsh criticism of UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. In a House floor speech last month, Solomon said Annan ought to be horsewhipped for his handling of talks with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to defuse the recent crisis over UN's weapons inspectors. Annan, a native of Ghana, has been widely praised for averting massive U.S. military action against Iraq, but Solomon saw him as putting Iraq's interests over those of the United States. New Jersey Democratic Congressmember Donald Payne, former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, called Solomon's remark a racist insult that conjures up, quote, the painful image of a black person being whipped into submission by his master. British scientists heading a major international breast cancer study yesterday blasted U.S. researchers for cutting short a drug trial and claiming that a drug halves the risk of developing the disease. The Britons, including the doctor who pioneered trials with the drug, tamoxifen, accused the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, of acting prematurely, jeopardizing the U.S. study and perhaps raising false hopes. At a news conference, they said the American researchers now won't be able to establish whether tamoxifen actually prevents cancer in high-risk women and saves lives or delays the onset of the disease. Attorney General Janet Reno will meet with Coretta Scott King, widow of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., about Mrs. King's request for a federal commission to investigate the King assassination, this according to a Justice Department spokesperson. The White House had announced earlier that President Clinton asked Reno to arrange such a meeting. Mrs. King said last week she believed the government has known since at least 1969 that James Earl Ray, who's serving a 99-year term after confessing to the slaying, did not act alone. 12 former Cuban political prisoners, including two jailed for exposing a government spy in dissident circles, came to Canada after being freed at the request of Pope John Paul II. The 12 former prisoners, along with about two dozen relatives, reached Toronto's Pearson International Airport after an overnight flight from Havana. The released prisoners and their families are free to remain in Canada, but some are expected to head to Florida because they have relatives in the huge expatriate Cuban community around Miami. The United States ambassador to Greece has become a source of dispute among politicians because of his outspoken opinions. Two high-ranking Greek politicians sparred in Parliament Monday over the conduct of Ambassador Nicholas Burns, who is the former State Department spokesperson. The Parliament Speaker, Apostolos Kaklamanis, said Burns acted like an anthropatos, which in ancient Greek was used to describe a deputy governor of Imperial Rome. It was the second time in a week Burns had been criticized by a senior Socialist Party official. Hong Kong lawmakers today exempted the Chinese state and post-colonial Hong Kong government from some privacy and anti-discrimination laws despite objections from groups that favor democracy, although the exemptions were also in effect for the British Crown and the colonial government under British control. Critics worry that China will chip away at the freedoms of the 6.5 million residents. Britain returned Hong Kong to China on July 1st. Paraguay has urged the World Court to order U.S. authorities to stay the execution of a Paraguayan who faces death by lethal injection in Virginia next week. In a last-ditch attempt to spare the life of convicted murderer Angel Francisco Brard, Paraguayan attorneys told the U.N. court Brard was not informed of his right to consular assistance after his arrest for a 1992 murder and attempted rape of Ruth Dickey in Arlington, Virginia. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. For nearly three decades, a California state legislative committee spied on 20,000 people documenting their personal habits, social lives, and political and professional relationships. For almost as long, the information has been kept secret in some 80 cartons in the California State Capitol Archives. Now the California Senate is deciding whether to allow historians to see the files, which were compiled by the California Senate Fact-Finding Subcommittee on Un-American Activities. The subcommittee's investigation began in 1939 and continued through the 60s. The legislature disbanded the panel and ordered its findings sealed in 1971. We're joined right now by Sandy Harrison, the press secretary for the California Senate President Pro Tem, John Burton. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, can you explain exactly what these files are, these tens of thousands of pages?
These are all of the records, all the memorandums, all of the communications created by this committee over a period of 30 years or more. They have been sealed since 1971 because, frankly, they contain some things that are quite vicious, that are false, scurrilous, arguably slanderous allegations against people, many of whom are still alive, that was gathered by this committee during this unfortunate period in history.
Who headed this committee?
Well, it was a committee headed by the leaders of the state Senate at that time. It was patterned after, of course, the federal House Un-American Activities Committee led by Senator Joseph McCarthy at that time. There was a state Senate leader in the 1950s named Hugh Burns, who was overseeing all of the Senate committees at that time as well.
And who understood what was going on during the years, the decades that these investigations were going on? How many people knew?
Oh, probably more than you might suspect. It was a time in our history when anyone with an arguably liberal or left-of-center political philosophy became suspect, and people who found political profit in persecuting those other folks found that it was in their best interest politically to fan the flames of that hysteria and to further those investigations and persecutions by perhaps spying on people, finding things that might be embarrassing, and then saying the way out is to name your friends. So it was quite widespread.
And so what is the controversy right now? Who doesn't want them opened?
What happened about a year ago, some scholars from the University of California who were researching this period in our history, were trying to get into these files and were getting stonewalled, were found that they were sealed and inaccessible. And they complained to my former boss, the former Senate leader, Senator Bill Lockyer, who is now running for Attorney General of California. They complained to him that there were these records that they felt they should have access to, which were being sealed. He ordered some staff members to look into that to figure out what was there and what could and couldn't be made public. His argument was that it ought to be made public, that unless there was some overwhelming reason not to, so he wanted to have more factual knowledge of what was there. At that point in time, for about a year, a fellow on our staff was indexing and organizing all this information and is reporting back now to the new Senate leader and the Senate Rules Committee of what is in there and what legal complications there may be to making this public. It's not really that there's anyone now who doesn't want this material public, but it's a question of how to best do it and at what risk do we put the state if there is, in fact, slanderous material that was gathered and could be released about people who are still living and who could still be hurt by the release of this material. are the taxpayers of California at risk? Could they be held liable for damages by the release of this information? Those are the types of things that we're trying to battle and figure out how best to release this material over time and to whom. Most people involved obviously think it's of great historical value and should be made public, and that's Senator Lockyer who started this. That has been his take on this.
Now, Sandy Harrison, your press secretary for the California Senate President Pro Tem John Burton right now, who is it that's reading these files, who are going through these files on 20,000 Californians?
Well, there's a fellow on the Senate staff by the name of Virgil Mybert. He's a consultant to our Rules Committee, and he was given that assignment. He and some secretarial clerical people went through it and organized all of the material, and he has not put together a specific report on what's in there. The committee did issue public reports during its existence, but those reports tended to be general, tended to be quite filtered compared to the actual communications and memorandums that the members of the committee exchanged with each other at that time. That's the material that we're talking about right now. So Mr. Mybert, he is going through all of that material, organizing it by source and by time period, and indexing everything and cross-indexing everything so that the Senate can take a good look at what's there and how the best way over time to organize the release of the material.
At least currently, can people apply to find out if there is a file on them and get those files personally?
I don't believe there's a way to do that yet. Hopefully...
Because it seems that should be able to happen before they're released to the public, because as you said, some of them can be incredibly damaging and scurrilous.
Certainly. I'm certain that that is something that the Senate Rules Committee is going to have to take into account, that they will be taking input on how to do this, and certainly if people feel that way, that would be a valid factor for them to advise the members of the Rules Committee on.
Do you see yourselves in California as setting a precedent? I'm sure that there are these kind of legislative committees around the country, not to mention the National House Committee on Un-American Activities, but in terms of how to deal with these files that so invaded the privacy of so many Americans.
Yeah, I certainly hope so, that as time passes and as we try to learn more from this period in our history, that more and more of what government did during that period becomes very public. There, as you may be aware, there was a case in Mississippi recently in which the state resisted opening some of their files, and they were ordered by federal courts to open the files, and this consisted of government intimidation of people involved in the civil rights movement. So hopefully we are in the forefront of this and that many other states will be following suit.
Sandy Harrison, thank you very much for joining us. Sandy Harrison is press secretary for the California Senate President Pro Tem John Burton. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! The debate in California comes only a few weeks after a federal judge in Mississippi ordered the State Department of Archives and History to unseal the records of the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, which from 1956 to 1977 operated a campaign of intimidation against civil rights workers and engaged in such actions as jury tampering and false imprisonment. But state harassment and political spying, whether by special commissions, legislative committees, or police, often paled in comparison to federal activities. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to talk to a lifelong fighter against state repression who was jailed for his political beliefs during the witch hunts of the McCarthy era. Howard Fast is 83 years old. He's the author of more than 86 books, many of which you may have read when you were a student in school or continue to read. Well, a few weeks ago, Democracy Now! Had the opportunity to go to Howard Fast's home in Old Greenwich, Connecticut, to talk to him about his life and about his experiences during the McCarthy era. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill, and we're sitting in the living room of Howard Fast, renowned author of historic fiction and the most prolific radical writer of the 20th century. His books range from Spartacus, about the slave revolt against the Roman Empire, to The Passion of Sacco and Vanzetti, the celebrated case of the two executed anarchists. He's written more than 50 books, including his memoir, which is called Being Read. Howard Fast was a war correspondent, jailed for his beliefs during the McCarthy era, and was also a dear friend of Paul Robeson. Can you tell us about the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee?
Well, you know, the first defense against fascism was in Spain when Franco took his army, his Moroccan army, across the Straits of Gibraltar and invaded Spain, actually invaded Spain to overthrow the Republic, the newly founded Republic of Spain. When that happened, the Spaniards, who were unprepared for a major war, fought against Franco, and Franco was very quickly joined by both Hitler and Mussolini, particularly by Hitler testing his Stuka dive bombers and his other weapons there in Spain. And ultimately, Spain was defeated, and a tremendous amount of Republican soldiers and their families fled north over the mountains, over the Pyrenees, to Toulouse. Now, in a group of us headed by Dr. Barsky, an incredible man who really created the MASH units that we used in Korea by taking a truck and turning it into an operating room and driving it up to the front lines and operating on the soldiers almost within minutes after they were hit. Barsky got a group of people together, raised money, and we had a very wide support. I always say everyone from Eleanor Roosevelt to Mrs. Lehman contributed to this, and we bought an old convent in Toulouse and turned it into a hospital. And the hospital was maintained by the Unitarians, and we supported the hospital. So the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee was chiefly a money-raising group in support of this hospital in Toulouse. But we had a large list of contributors, and the House Committee on Un-American Activities, Mr. Rankin's committee, subpoenaed our books, which meant that everyone who had given a dollar to the to our committee, and this was at the worst moment of what we call McCarthyism today, that everyone who had given us money would be subpoenaed by the House Committee and would suffer through that subpoena. We couldn't do it. So we refused to surrender the books, and we were all sent to jail. We fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court, which refused to take our case, and finally we went to jail in 1950. What is very interesting is that in the record of my hearing, they expunged the following material. In the course of their questioning, as they did with everyone, they asked me whether I was in the service of a foreign agent, or was I a foreign agent? And I said, yes, I'm in the service of an authority. And they said, is this authority outside of the United States? I said, yes. They said, do you obey orders from them? I said, yes. And at that point, they got so excited, I thought they would pop their skins, because they had finally found. And they said, are you ready, Mr. Fass, to name the authority? And I said, yes, I'll name the authority. They said, very well, name it. And I said, God. He said, get that bastard out of here. I'll give him a shred of the doubt that they were referring to me and not to God. But so that was my high moment. And they expunged it from the record, which I felt very bad about. But these were star chamber proceedings. No lawyer was allowed to be with you. You were there all alone. And it was difficult. The question was, they wanted to entrap me. I had nothing to hide or to be entrapped with. But they were quite a group of men.
Legendary author Howard Fast will be back with him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now!'s Jeremy Scahill as we continue our conversation with author Howard Fast at his home in Old Greenwich, Connecticut.
Many of your books are semi-autobiographical, and you portray in a number of books the experience of people who were jailed during the McCarthy era. Could you talk about some of the hardship that people jailed during the McCarthy era faced while in prison?
Well, this it's somewhat different. See, the Commissioner of Federal Prisons then, in the first place, I believe there were only 17,000 people in federal prisons then. Today we have in prison or going to prison or on parole over 2 million people, the largest amount of prisoners of any country in the world. As a matter of fact, every prisoner costs the American taxpayer $35 a day. So multiply the days of the year by $35 and multiply that by 2 million, and you get a notion of what our lunatic drug policy, our demented prison policy, is costing us. But when I went to prison, the federal prisons had a wonderful man as the top director of the federal prison system. His name was James Bennett. And Bennett called a group of psychologists together, of penal psychologists and criminal psychologists, and asked them to design a modern prison. And the first thing they did was to say you had to do away with the wall. Said, if you have no wall, no prisoner can escape. And they set up this prison at Mill Point in West Virginia. It covered about, 10 acres. And there were army bunkhouses there. No door was ever locked, no wall, just a circle of signs, and each sign said, stay inside. Now, the prisoners sent there, no prisoner had more than 2 years left to serve when he was sent there. And the penalty for escaping was 5 years. So in the 18 or 20 years that this prison existed, only about a dozen men had tried to escape. And when they escaped, they had just walked out, gone home to whatever town or village they came from, and the warden would phone the local sheriff and he'd pick them up, send them back. Everyone worked at the prison, and while I hate prison, I hate the whole concept of prison, I must say this was the most intelligent and humane prison probably that existed in America. And the warden, a man by the name of Tiemann, was a very decent man, a very decent man. And so I hate to say that I enjoyed the experience, but I had always had a feeling that a writer should be in prison for some time at least, just so you write about, so you could write about what it means to be in prison. I think a writer should see a little bit of prison, a little bit of war. Neither of these things can be properly invented. So that was my prison. Now, the book you referred to is called The Pledge. And I tell the story of a man who is sent to this prison because he refuses to name names before the House Un-American Committee. He was not raped, but he was... I selected the one prisoner in our prison to use as a model for this, who was a kind of an insane thug. He worked in the garage, prison garage. So I set out a confrontation between him and this man. But aside from this, I have serious complaints about my being sent to prison, because I had done nothing to be sent to prison. I committed no crime, but I have no complaints against the prison itself.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill, and our guest is author Howard Fast, or I should say we're his guests because we're sitting in his living room in front of an open fire, and I won't let the listeners know, Howard, that you smoke. We'll move on from there.
But only cigars.
We'll forgive you anyway. I wanted to ask quickly about some of your earlier works, for example, The Passion of Sacco and Vanzetti. For young listeners today, Sacco and Vanzetti, I bet, does not ring a bell. Why were they, these two anarchists, significant in your life and in the history of the United States?
Well, they were significant because their case, and they were both put to death, their case was one of a great many innocent men who were put to death or sent to jail for long periods of time on the basis that they opposed the government. Now, an anarchist is not a bomb thrower. Anarcho-syndicalism is a way of thinking. It's a movement. And what it means in the crudest, briefest way is ownership of factories by the men who work in these factories. So the anarchist movement is not essentially, it has nothing to do with this vision of anarchists as destroyers or bomb throwers. Sacco and Vanzetti were two Italian working men who preached, to one extent or another, the anarchist philosophy. For this, they were framed for a murder that they did not commit, and the evidence against them was so small, so poor, and so manipulated that it really aroused the conscience of America. And thousands of men and women in the 1920s, late 1920s, were drawn in this movement to save Sacco and Vanzetti. And it was futile, and they were put to death. I wrote the book because this was the kind of a drama that had meaning far beyond the contents of the story. It might have been a story about John Brown, who was also put to death for his attack on the slaveholders. It could have been the story of Joe Hill, who was shot to death by a firing squad in Utah because he was a leader of the mine workers there. The story was repeated over and over throughout our history, but I felt that by telling the story of Sacco and Vanzetti, it could be highlighted.
Could you talk about the impact that the execution of the Rosenbergs had on you?
Well, that is something that stays with me. I don't know how much of it is known now, but certainly every listener remembers that what's-his-name in the CIA, who betrayed the CIA for Soviet money and who sent a number of CIA workers to their deaths, did not get the death sentence. And the Department of Justice G-Man, who went into being a spy for the Soviet Union and was finally caught, did not get the death sentence. The death sentence was reserved for the Rosenbergs. And there's much I could say about the Rosenberg case. The movement to save the Rosenbergs was begun by a man called Julian Trupin, T-R-U-P-I-N, a wonderful, wonderful man, who was one of my dearest friends, and myself. We began that movement, and it grew from there. And we did it because we felt that under the circumstances, they were not guilty. There's a long, involved story to this, and I don't want to take up the rest of this interview with it, but I must tell you this, that I went to my dentist during, I can't give the exact date, but it was just before Judge Kaufman pronounced the death sentence on the Rosenbergs. As I sat in the waiting room of the dentist, a man came out, wiping his eyes, and walked through and left. The dentist came out, and he said, "Howard, you know who that was?" I said, "No, who was it?" "That was Judge Kaufman." Then the dentist tells me that on the dentist chair, in the dental chair, he told the dentist that he was called to Washington by President Truman, and that Truman showed him a folder which contained enough evidence against Kaufman's brother to send him to jail for the rest of his life for tax fraud. And he said, "Make your choice. Either you send the Rosenbergs to their deaths, deliver a verdict of death in the electric chair, or your brother spends the rest of his life in jail." Now, my dentist, and Kaufman said to my dentist, "I'm going out of my mind." He said, "I pleaded with Truman that if I do this, I will be an outcast among the Jews for the rest of my life. Don't lay this on me." Truman showed him no mercy. "Either your brother goes to jail or you sentence the Rosenbergs to death." My dentist said to Kaufman, "You can't ask me about what you should do. For God's sake, go to your rabbi." He said, "I went to my rabbi, and the rabbi said I must follow my own conscience," which is a very neat way of getting out of it. Anyway, that was the incident that happened in my dentist's waiting room. I don't believe many people know about this story.
That's what I call filling in history.
Yes, it fills in a bit of history. and Kaufman sentenced them to death, and they died.
Now, in 1953, you were awarded the Stalin International Peace Prize, and Paul Robeson actually presented it to you. Now, I know that you had trouble with the non-aggression pact signed between Stalin and Hitler, and you also were influential in canceling the visit of a Russian musician who was going to participate in a concert with a Nazi supporter. Could you talk about how you ended up breaking with the Communist Party?
Well, I would say that less than breaking with the Communist Party, the Communist Party broke. It ended. It came to an end. The Communist Party, as I knew it, that small party in America, came to an end with the 20th Congress of the Soviet Communist Party. This was the Congress in Moscow where Khrushchev spoke for several hours. He delivered a speech of 20,000 words. There was a Hungarian communist present, and this Hungarian sold his copy of the speech. The speech was only given to those who were there at this Congress. He sold his copy to the CIA, and they gave it to the State Department. The State Department gave it to the New York Times. The editor of the New York Times called called the editor of the Daily Worker, and he said, "We have the Khrushchev speech. Do you want it?" He said, "We're going to publish it in tomorrow's paper in full, 20,000 words." And Johnny said, "Yes, we want it." And he called a meeting of the whole staff, and we sat there, and this was read to us. And we heard this speech, and many of us wept, because we did not know and would not believe the truth about the Soviet Union. We had erected a socialist state to our beliefs and to our dreams, and this, for us, was the Soviet Union. And we heard this speech read there, and a wonderful man, a good friend, had been the Daily Worker correspondent in Moscow for 2 years. And he said to Johnny Gates, "Do you believe now that if I were caught with a copy of the New York Times in Moscow, I would be sent to prison?" Then Joe told us this story he had heard in Moscow, that Stalin always kept a revolver by his desk. And when a women's committee for relief in the Ukraine, where there was a famine, begged Stalin's wife to go to him and beg him to send food to the Ukraine, she went to him. She dropped to her knees and wept and pleaded with him, and he took his revolver and shot her through the head. When we told this story to the New York Times, they refused to publish it. They said, "It's unbelievable, and we can't publish something that's absolutely unbelievable." It was unbelievable to us, too, but we knew it was the truth, because Joe Clark, our correspondent in Moscow, got it from sources that knew it was the truth. With that meeting of the staff of the Daily Worker, I think the Communist Party of America came to an end. The next day, the Daily Worker was the only paper in the world that published the full 20,000 words of Khrushchev's text. And once that was published, there was no more Communist Party. But we had to publish it. There was no way we could not publish it.
Howard Fast, acclaimed novelist and author of more than 86 books, speaking to him in his home in Old Greenwich, Connecticut. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230 for a cassette copy. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back with Howard Fast in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill as we continue our conversation with Howard Fast, activist, novelist, author of more than 86 books.
Having been a member of the Communist Party for more than a decade, how did this paradigm shift affect your worldview and affect your writing?
Well, I had already felt what it meant to be blacklisted with Spartacus. No publishing company would publish Spartacus. I published it myself, and it became a bestseller.
And Spartacus was about the slave revolt?
The slave revolt in ancient times against Rome. After I left the party, it made front page news in the New York Times, and the blacklist for me ended. But what really ended the blacklist, smashed it to shreds, was the making of the movie Spartacus, because Dalton Trumbo, who wrote the screenplay along with me, he wrote part of it. I wrote about a third of it. Trumbo was also known as a member of the Communist Party and had been imprisoned. And his name was on the screenplay, and the picture broke through. And when Kennedy played an early version of the picture at the White House, then that was the end of the blacklist. Of course, the real end of the tyranny of that time, and J. Edgar Hoover and Senator McCarthy, came when Eisenhower was elected president. And while people don't give him the credit, he should have a lot of the credit of making short shrift of McCarthy in the Army hearing. Actually, although it's little understood, what we call the McCarthy time was really the Truman time. Truman issued an executive order for every non-elected official to take a loyalty oath in which you swore that you were never a member of the Communist Party or an associate of anyone who was a member of the party. And this spread like wildfire. State after state picked it up. And literally hundreds and hundreds of teachers lost their jobs and became unemployable. It wreaked havoc in Hollywood, as most people know. And for years, some of the best people in Hollywood could not find work. It was picked up by a supermarket magnate who published a book called Red Channels, which had the names of everyone who had been accused of being a communist. Also included was the name of the then Secretary of State and a number of other people in the government who were as far from being communists as Truman was. But I think that the bomb that finally exploded this was the film Spartacus.
Now, there were some people that came out of the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings strengthened by their experience, and you talked about your jail experience, but there are others whose lives were absolutely devastated. Could you talk about some of those lives of people who were devastated by the House Un-American Activities Committee, whether it was by their careers being ruined or by the fact that they had talked to the committee and perhaps named names?
It worked both ways. One of those who named names, Ilya Kazan, suffered for years. And
why did he do it?
I think any of those, all of those who did it, were afraid. You know, it's great to be a hero when your country is behind you and the flags are waving and the media is trumpeting your glories and so forth. But to be a hero when you're alone in that House hearing room and to know that if you don't name names, you will never work again in your profession, that you will be ruined financially, that your friends will shun you. This is something else. At least three people I know of at the time killed themselves after this. One of the men who killed himself had named names. Two others didn't name names, but they were so thoroughly ruined in their craft that they saw no way out. If you were a teacher, you would never teach again at any high school, college, university. And fear is a funny thing. You never know how afraid you can be until you confront a situation which threatens you. And it threatens in a variety of ways. So people did not name names and suffered. People named names and suffered again. It was a strange time that's almost impossible to recreate today.
Again, our guest, renowned author Howard Fast. Another chapter of history is one that continues through today, and it's how we ended up first talking just a little while ago on Democracy Now!, and it is the story and life of Paul Robeson, who is a dear friend of yours. Paul Robeson, who you knew through these very difficult times. And as I was wondering, as we move into the 100th anniversary of the birth of the great activist, scholar, actor, singer, athlete, Renaissance man who is Paul Robeson, if you could talk a little about your friendship with him.
Well, he was an extraordinary man. I'll repeat some of the facts that should be well known now and I hope will be better known. He was the first black man to play on a football team of white college. He was a brilliant athlete and a brilliant scholar. He was second or third in his class, and he delivered the valedictorian speech. He then went to law school and got his law degree and passed his bar. When he sang at various opportunities that he had then as a young man. He realized that he had a unique voice. I don't think there was ever a voice like it. He dedicated himself to the struggle against racism. He wrote his valedictorian address on the question of racism. He never veered from that struggle. He supported, in the worst Senator McCarthy days, he supported the handful of people who refused to be silenced. For this, he was called before the Un-American Committee, whose questions he refused to answer. Internationally, he was too gigantic a figure to be put in jail. It wasn't practical, so they did not proceed against him. But this was a man who, before he went before the House Un-American Committee, day or two before, had dinner at my house, and he said, "What am I going to tell them when they ask me whether I'm a communist?" And I said, "You tell them you're not a communist. You never were a communist." He said, "But then I've sung before the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in Spain. I've sung for the Spanish Republicans. I've sung for the Soviet Army that liberated Germany. I've sung everywhere, and all of these people think I'm a communist. And if I go down there and say I'm not a communist, how will I ever face them again?" The result was that he simply refused to answer their questions. Again, I could go on and on talking about Paul Robeson.
But just to clarify, on that point, it wasn't that he wanted to deceive people into thinking he was a communist, right? But rather that to say he wasn't was to say that there was something wrong with them?
He didn't want to face the fact that he had never joined the Communist Party. "How can I explain it?" he asked. Now, that's an odd thing to think today, the way history unfolds via the media. But history is one thing and the media is something else, and the two of them rarely connect.
Would you include Paul Robeson among those who were broken by the McCarthy period?
Yes, he was. Utterly broken. After the committee called him, he could not sing in any concert hall, could not play in any film, could not act on any stage. The only place he could sing was, before left-wing audiences or in black churches. He was terribly disheartened, terribly broken by it. He could sing in Europe, and he did, to overwhelming crowds. But that is different. During the blacklist, my books were published everywhere in the world but in America. But that meant nothing to me. If the Czechs published my books, I couldn't read Czech. If someone else published my books, I couldn't read the reviews. I wanted them published here in America. And that couldn't be done.
Kind of like hearing an echo of your own voice.
Yes, only an echo. I was more fortunate than most because my books could be published and I could get royalties from abroad. Most of them couldn't.
I heard you recently speak at Long Island University, which had an all-day retrospective or series of speeches about Paul Robeson. And you talked about the Peekskill concert when he was able to sing before thousands of people, but the price that everyone paid for that concert.
Yes, that was a terrible incident. A great crowd gathered to hear him speak in these picnic grounds. And we had a wall around the place, a wall of human beings, and a dozen men around Paul, because they had threatened to kill him.
Veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade fighting Spain's Franco.
Most of them were veterans of the Lincoln Brigade, most of the men around Paul. They did root out of the woods and the hillside above the valley two men with rifles who were there to kill Paul. The police would not arrest them, and nothing happened to them. The concert went peacefully, and Paul sang his heart out. But meanwhile, the hoodlums, protected by the police and state troopers, had gathered piles of rocks at every overpass leading out of the place. And as the people left, their cars were hammered by rocks and smashed, and dozens of people had to be hospitalized. And it was a terrible scene. This was an enormous incident, which is totally forgotten. Not even a footnote in the history books of the time.
Howard Fast, how do you want to be remembered by generations to come?
To remember me will not accomplish a great deal, but I think to read the books that I have written, these books have a power of their own, an existence of their own. So the blacklist is just wearing off. I know that in a number of colleges, they're beginning to teach courses in my work. That's something new. When I'm dead, and if the books are around, that's more than I could have ever dreamed of.
Well, I'm happy to note that despite your smoking of that cigar, you are not dead, and you grace us with your presence. You continue to grace us with your presence, and I want to thank you very much for spending this time with us.
I only smoke cigars when I work, and being interviewed is very hard work. But thank you. Thank you so much for letting me get some of this off my mind. You think you have enough?
Well, Howard Fast, we will never have enough of you or your work, and again, we thank you. Well, folks, that does it for this edition of Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a cassette copy of this interview with Howard Fast, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Howard Fast, the author of more than 80 books, including such classics as Freedom Road, The Passion of Sacco and Vanzetti, and Spartacus, which was made into a famous film with Kirk Douglas. In fact, the music you've heard throughout today's show is from that film, Spartacus, the original soundtrack. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with Jeremy Scahill, Errol Maitland engineered, Michelle Garcia is our webmaster, Julie Drizin is our executive producer. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to our email address at democracy@pacifica.org, and we are broadcast on the internet. Just go to www.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill.